So I am a professor at Loyola University Chicago. My main appointment is in the School of Nursing, where I teach in an undergraduate program in health systems management. And I also have a joint appointment at the Department of Public Health Sciences, which is in the medical school, the Stritch Medical School at Loyola. Not to go into too much detail of my life, but last year, 2014, I retired from the University of Illinois Chicago School of Public Health, where I'd been for 36 years. And I thought to myself, well, whew, now I'm at that stage where I can do anything I want to. So what am I going to do? And I came up with an idea, which was to see whether or not we could, in fact, put together a team of people in Chicago to spend a few years actually developing a model for the impact of the Affordable Care Act in our community. And so I started the process. And by the way, I'm sorry, I don't have any financial interest in this. I started the process and started reaching out to people, thinking that, well, I'm retired, I can do anything I want. And then I got really tired of being retired. It's a terrible thing. It's really awful. And so I thought, well, what can I do to add stress to my life? And I said, well, I know how to be a professor. That's a very stressful. For those of you who think it looks easy, you should try it. They offered me a job at Loyola, and I grabbed it. That did two things for this project. One is, three things actually. One is that it stretched out the time horizon a bit, and so we haven't accomplished nearly as much as we'd hoped by now. The other is that it gave me all of the resources of Loyola, which is a very large university, to pull into the project. And third, it gave me undergraduates whom I had never taught before. 36 years of teaching graduate students. This is my first time teaching undergraduates. And so I wanted to get all of these people involved in this project. Is the Affordable Care Act working? Yeah, I don't know either. And if you don't think it is, why do you not think so? Or if you do think it is in some areas, what evidence do you have of that? So the idea was to figure out what are the standards by which we can judge whether the Affordable Care Act is actually working. You know, is it the number of people insured? That certainly has been a plus. But it's a plus with a big negative, because 30 million people are not going to be insured when it's all done. The number of people actually getting care, that turns out to be different from the number of people insured. The impact on the quality of care. I'm a professor of public health, and so I care about implementation of public health measures, which has started but isn't remotely as robust as people had expected. Are we going to reduce costs? It's the Affordable Care Act. And, you know, how ironic is that going to be? So certainly there are a lot of people who are insured that weren't insured before. You all know this list, right? There are no pre-existing conditions. There's no lifetime caps. Medicare got expanded significantly in a lot of states and not at all in a lot of states. There's a baseline of coverage for all policies today. Free preventive screening in every policy, which is a huge step forward. But, you know, costs are still going up. And yes, they've slowed down, but they're still going up, and they're going up a multiple of inflation. People have insurance, but the care may not be affordable because of co-pays and deductibles and co-insurance. That's one of the interesting things, by the way. You all know those three things. I had to explain that to my undergrads. What's the difference between those? We may be seeing, it's a little early to tell, but we may be seeing the decline of the number of people enrolled as the costs of insurance go up, as the threat of the penalty or tax doesn't carry as much weight as maybe we thought it did. The expanded Medicare is being paid for by the federal taxpayers at the moment, but that will shift over the next few years to only 90% by the federal tax, and 10% might actually be a lot of money to some states. And the inescapable, hideous moral truth is that the Affordable Care Act is not universal care, that tens of millions of people will not have insurance and therefore not have health care. And it's not random. The people who are in that 30 million are not random. We don't know exactly who they're going to be, but we know it's not random. And since it's not random, it's a health justice issue, because whoever those people are likely to be vulnerable populations. And when you look on the broader basis, we still spend twice as much as most other countries, and the outputs of our supposed system, one of the things I'm teaching the undergrads is that we don't really have a system, but the outputs of whatever you want to call this system is seriously inferior to most of the rest of the developed world, and we're still the only developed country with private, for-profit, largely unregulated insurance companies. And nothing of those things seems like it's going to change under the Affordable Care Act. So what's working and what isn't? We don't really know. So this is the project we decided to put together. We wanted to develop a model that we would be able to pour the data that we know about in Chicago into that model, and it would tell us some of the areas in which the Affordable Care Act is working and some of the areas where it's still failing us. We are hoping that what we come up with will be broadly applicable to other communities, and so we will have developed something which we can hand to wherever you're from, and to the extent that it looks somewhat like Chicago, there ought to be some benefit to figuring out what's happening in your community. It's going to take us a year or so to get organized and secure funding, and then a minimum of 18 months to develop the model, and then another 6 months or so to disseminate the results. So this is a three-year project that I thought I had embarked on back when I was retired, and now is something that I'm going back to pick up. So far, we have a lot of people involved. Nobody has said no that we've asked. We've got a number of Loyola departments here, the Chicago Department of Public Health, the Heinz Research Service, the Illinois Hospital Association, and it's going on as we speak. We are not yet ready to pull together a project team, but our idea is to have a very, very small professional core and then some paid experts to serve as a board of advisors, and then a very large advisory committee that represents a lot of the different people in the Chicago area. We're hoping to get more governmental people involved, more of the hospital and medical groups involved. Chicago is home to a number of pharmaceuticals, and we'd like to have representatives from them. We will need people from the insurance industry for all kinds of reasons, not the least of which is they know more about this than all the rest of us put together. And we're going to want to have labor representatives. So we're going to begin this search starting in a couple of months for the rest of the team. But what criteria should we choose? Well, so I gave this to my class as a project. The class is called Healthcare in America. It's the U.S. healthcare system. 30 students, most of them sophomores in my program in health systems management. And I asked them to investigate the literature and recommend criteria for evaluating the U.S. healthcare system. And I thought, you know, a group of 19-year-olds in a thing that they know nothing about, that they'd come up with, you know, about a dozen criteria. So they came up with 40. And we can group these. I think I can get this down to about 30 by grouping. But that's amazing. And a lot of criteria that we didn't even think about ahead of time. So, you know, I can't go through that whole list with you just to show you 40 of them. And then I asked them to rank these criteria, and they ended up ranking 26 of them. 16 of them. And the numbers here are the rankings, so the lower the number, the higher the ranking. And it's interesting that the top three are accessibility, quality of care, and affordability. That's right there, not a bad start. But when you start looking at all of these things, you realize these are a bunch of 19-year-olds who went out into a literature they don't know, and they figured out what we should be looking at. So it can't be as hard as I thought. And one of the interesting things when you do this, when you ask people who don't have preconceived notions, they might come up with something you never occur to you. So the tied for 14th, 15th, and 16th in the rankings was the humanity of the system, which is such a good idea that I never would have thought of, but my students did. These are my students. So we are going to be doing this project, and frankly, one of the main reasons I'm here is to start the process of soliciting input from as wide a group of people as we can. So that is my email, dswartzman@luc for Loyola University Chicago.edu. I'd be happy to make my slides available if you give me your card, and I would very much like to hear from you about what you think the relevant criteria are that we could apply in doing this study in Chicago, and what we would need to do to actually make it useful in your community. And then hopefully when we start actually getting some results, we'll report back in a future meeting. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was, I have to say, congratulations to our program committee. That proceeded very well. I think the ordering of those worked really exceptionally well. Alas, we are out of time officially. Everybody used up their full 15 minutes. But if they're willing, you could come up and ask them questions one-on-one. No? Till two. My for 15. What I have here goes to, so we have what, an hour for panel discussion?
Half an hour.
Till two. Because this just says, I'm on the app here, and oh, I see. All the presents. Fine. I'm the emergency backup moderator. I apologize. All right. So, questions? Yes, ma'am.
No, we actually, there are a couple of people, it was a lack of clarity on my part. There are a couple of people on the list, like Health and Medicine Policy Research Group and the Public Health Institute of Chicago, who are going to undertake a widespread community part. I just didn't make that clear. It was really
it gets left off of a lot of things that are happening and trying to address
Mark Lebo from Rochester, Minnesota. I thought there was a lovely presentation about what people on the ground think of PACA is or isn't doing. I was just curious, you know, because on the ACA path, there were some people on the political side of the world that the main thing is basically this. The downside is the chance of the ACA, we now all our problem numbers. Because whatever wasn't working around the ACA is wrong. Even if it wasn't working before the ACA, now it's wrong. Have you thought about asking, or maybe just as a day together, what did you think the ACA was going to do? What changes do you think the ACA was going to make? I mean, I'm from a very different part of the state. We adopted all three, the expansion, the basic concept, the whole share. But we, even where I am, we have a lot of folks, physicians and elite people who don't really understand the too much of the literature, the more for sure, and the better. But sometimes when we ask people what they thought the ACA did, and I ask masters, I teach,
Well, our specific question was describe to the community members some basic provisions after they beat any of that, and what impact they sort of felt firsthand or from other family members or community members that they knew that had affected them since implementation. So the only one thing refreshing we have, remember, it's part of a larger product from the Rural Health Public Home Training Center. So it's very just one question focused on the ACA. It's something that we could perhaps go back and ask, like you're saying, that probably would be a great follow-up with some of the community members and the data collection process ongoing now.
Yes, ma'am.
We did not collect that data. All that we required from them was that they were living in the county that we sampled them at, and I wouldn't be able to give you that information at the moment.
So on my midterm exam, I asked them, what is accessibility? And I'm pleased to say that they talked about geographic accessibility as well as financial accessibility and cultural accessibility accessibility for vulnerable populations. They get that it's a much broader issue. I did the survey before I wrote the midterm exam, and I wanted to know what did they think accessibility meant when they voted for it. But they had no three thoughts too. Is there anything that we left out here? Is there anything that we may have left out of that? No, I'm saying specifically with accessibility.
And to piggyback on that, some of the other work we're doing in California out in South Sacramento, it's really, you know, there's this understanding now that it's not just about having an insurance card, it's not just about having insurance and the coverage, it's how do you get the care even after you've got the coverage, and you know, how do you use the insurance that you have. And so one of the pilot studies that we're doing down in South Sacramento with support from the Sierra Health Foundation is we've identified, you know, 7 high need zip codes in South Sacramento that we know, you know, there's a lot of high poor health outcomes, racially ethnically diverse populations, low income areas. So we're really focusing on these zip codes, and what we've done is we're surveying 300 of these individuals from these 7 zip codes, including half of them will be newly insured, half of the sample is uninsured, and we want to identify post-ACA, what has this insurance card meant for you? And how does that compare to experiences with the uninsured? Have the insurance made a difference in access? And we're really focusing a lot on what you identified. You know, how do community members define access? Especially from what this conference has been about, you know, from the upstream perspective, the social determinant perspective. You know, how does language play out? How does transportation play out? Geographic accessibility, as you mentioned. And so it's really about obtaining some of those community voices to understand how has access and that landscape changed, both for the uninsured and for the newly insured. So I just thought I'd piggyback on that. And so there's some community work going on around that as well, if you're interested.
Yes, ma'am. And the front?
I'm just curious. I have an insurance card now, and there is something for me to access. But how do I know the value of that commodity for prevention, for example? I've never been exposed to a dentist before. Now you give me a dental card in Wisconsin that doesn't help you at all. You don't have any dentists. There's a piece in the middle that's between I have a card and there's something to access, and whether I have any idea that that's of value to me. Is that measured anywhere?
So one of the things we're looking at in some of our other work now is almost that mid-roll that you're talking about in terms of, you know, Is there a role now beyond, we know, you know, there are navigators, consumer assisters out there who are helping people enroll, and then we know there's the care there. But what we're coming to also learn and what we're looking at now is that role for, say, a navigator to go to that next level to help someone understand what is it that you need to be accessing. Did you know that, you know, your insurance covers a whole host of preventive health services? Do you know that this is how you can get there? And so there's this, what you describe as a gap. It's a hole. And so we're hearing more and more about it. And I think there are programs happening around to address that gap. But I mean, you said it very clearly. So that's some of the work that we're doing is trying to see how do we bridge that coverage to care gap, with trying to identify some opportunities for bridging it.
Yeah, so what we're talking about doing is looking at a couple of the countries that have not just a card, but a whole system in place of continuity of care. See that as a model, and then compare what's actually happening to that model. And so the gaps we expect will show up when we do that.
I've got a couple questions lined up here. First, you, I think.
I think there's great recognition that there is a gap between having a card and using it. And I'll just call folks' attention. You'll have to Google it. I can't remember the website. But it's Coverage to Care. And that's the program that CMS has initiated. And it has a roadmap to care and explain care, and there are whole teaching modules associated with it so that you're moving step by step with people. I think there are 8 steps on exactly, you know, what card can be used for, how do you make an appointment, what types of questions should you be asking your healthcare provider when you do make that appointment. And the materials are available in several different languages. Initially, this was not developed, but it was discovered that people had cards, but they weren't accessing care. So that's why they implemented that program.
And Smith?
So I just wanted to have kind of a follow-up question to the study that y'all are doing in California with the difficult, and it's related to the health literacy aspect of folks are bringing up.
That's right.
And one is just wondering if y'all are asking questions around that, measuring that in any sort of way. And two, in sort of plug, I work with Rachel Lynch-Wishy for the Health Care Women's Union. We just finished developing a health literacy guide to help women specifically understand and learn how to use their health insurance. It goes into the preventative care. It goes into what services are free, which I think is some, you know, it's just, I'm definitely aware of that, the fact that they created, but I think ours is able to kind of break down the structure, even in really explaining health insurance, co-payment, deductible, those kind of terms are really difficult. And we're going to be talking about that in the next session this afternoon at 4:30 in UNCC 1-1-2. It's a DAC club, but we're translating those as well and trying to figure out, you know, what, especially within the fashion community, because a lot of folks either fall in the gap right now, so we're going to say, as in Atlanta, or just are left out of ADA because they're undocumented. So we're trying to find kind of like the group of people that are documented, that are eligible, that could be needed, and I'm not just finding that as well.
So we are, for the study we had in California, we are looking at, we were asking the literacy and language proficiency question from two perspectives. One is trying to understand their own, you know, what they identify as the language that they're proficient in. Are they, you know, do they speak English very well, less than very well? So identifying English language proficiency, what language they do speak in. Identifying, you know, understandability, how understandable was the information that was provided to them on health insurance, on accessing care. So we are asking some of those understandability questions. The flip is also we're trying to understand the capacity within the system and how individuals feel, you know, if they asked for an interpreter, did they get one, for example. Not only in the context of a healthcare setting, but also in context of obtaining health insurance. So when they were in the process of getting insurance, were they able to speak to an interpreter? So it's really from both perspectives, it's understanding their characteristics and you know, their language proficiency and preferences, but then it's also trying to understand through them what the systemic kind of gaps might be around addressing language and literacy post-ACA. And again, a comparison of, we're really excited about this comparison of uninsured and newly insured, because there's also now this notion that the landscape has changed for the uninsured as well, because so many of us are focused on getting the newly insured in and newly insured access. And so what about those that are remaining uninsured? That focus is no longer exclusively there, it's kind of distributed. And so their landscape and the resources that once focused on them are kind of distributed as well. So we hope we'll get, you know, some indication from that.
Yes, ma'am.
I have a question about the Medicaid expansion in Tennessee. I thought it was really interesting under the insurer Tennessee proposal that the hospitals actually stepped up and offered to fund Medicaid after the federal government pulled out. Just kind of thinking about the concept of hospital-sponsored health insurance. Mm-hmm. The first time I had heard of it related to Medicaid, and I was just wondering if there's kind of a precedent in other states that hospitals are stepping up and doing that. I was just wondering if there was precedent for hospitals kind of stepping up the way that they offer to do in Tennessee in terms of funding Medicaid from the federal government.
I'm not quite sure. From my research, it sounded like Tennessee was the first state to do it, but I could be wrong.
Can you speak louder, please?
Oh, sorry. From my research, I'm not sure exactly. From what I saw, Tennessee was the first state to incorporate hospitals that offered to pay for the coverage gap. So I mean, Arkansas and Missouri modified their Medicaid expansion plan, so did Kentucky. But I'm not looking to how they did it exactly. So they might have the same type of plan, but from what I see, Tennessee was the only state to have the hospitals or volunteers to pay for that coverage gap.
There are really large hospital systems that are starting to realize that they could be their health insurer.
Right.
And they're thinking about cutting out the health insurance companies.
And And that's the example that I gave earlier. Well, you weren't here, but it was Boeing, for example. Their employees are partnering with the healthcare system, with University of Washington, with Harborview directly, to where, you know, it's a global kind of amount of payment we're going to get for your employees to care for your employees. If you're able to provide services below that amount that Boeing is giving, you keep the profits. And you reinvest it in any way you want. But if you're not able to, then you reap the, you know, you have to cover the difference.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I have a couple of questions for Dr. Cindy. Sorry if they were asked.
Not doctor.
The on your slides seem to be well-resourced and rather better off than the typical taking a hospital or a community health center. So I don't know to what extent your findings generalize to those other institutions that seem to be left out of the pie.
Absolutely, and you know, that was something that we were striving to do. We didn't just want to go with the Denver Healths and with the Cambridge Health Alliances, although they were included. Our criteria, as I mentioned, was we really did want to go with institutions that were in these Medicaid expansion states, and then the second set of criteria was making sure that we're going with a system that really has a very high uncompensated care pool. And so based on that, we were really left with about 15 systems. I wouldn't say, you know, I think they are all, the 10 included from the American Essential Hospitals are at varying spectrums of you know, their financial standing. Some are really are very well to do. Others that we spoke to did mention, you know, for example, the DSH payment reductions that are expected. I mean, depending on how they're able to attract and retain newly insured patients, once those kick in, they're actually worried about being able to continue to provide the services they do provide. So they're, you know, I think some of these systems are very well to do or doing well. They figured it out. They're innovating. They're transforming. Others are doing okay, but it could go any way with just all the changes that are happening. So if they don't stay on, you know, if they don't keep transforming and keeping up with this rapid pace of change, then they could very well be cutting services.
And relevant to that is the kind of disparity in ACO participation. So there's evidence that shows that some of the ACOs that form are more likely to form in urban, more affluent areas and support.
That's
so
right.
So in your example, the ones that did not participate in ACOs, I think it was about half of them. So do you have any idea why they did not participate, or did
so,
they
say, yeah, a few of them told us, you know, explicitly that they, there were at least two who mentioned we're not participating now, but our plan in the long term is to be a part of the ACO. But the problem really is many of these systems aren't prepared to take the risk. And that's what one explicitly shared was, you know we need to be there and we know we need to be a part of these partnerships, but we just don't have the capital, the resources, and the infrastructure yet to get there. And that's exactly what you're saying is, you know, that they're oftentimes they're not seen as desirable partners in these ACOs. And so a lot of them are really focusing on how do we build the building block, which is if ACO is our vision, for example, let's get our medical homes all set up, certified and running as they should be to get to that vision that they might have.
The question back there? You? Yeah.
I'm just going to comment to your question. I'm from Utah, and I'm, you know, that one state that's always a different color when you talk about Medicaid expansion because you can't decide.
Yeah.
But the latest, actually, it's not even the latest. We've gone through several proposals. Our story is not very similar to Tennessee.
Okay.
But the latest proposal was to have the hospitals and the healthcare system pitch in to help cover some of that cost. I know Utah is looking at that as well. Like I said, we've gone through several iterations, and I don't know that that's.
There might still be hope.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Well, the disquieting thing about the Affordable Care Act is that it's a market-based approach to health care. And all the things that Florida's down, I think some of the objections are that we kind of hope that they, that the idea that doctors are only spending 2 minutes with a patient, that they're not, because, you know, they're the only time insurance, and they have to do all the throughput, and they have to do EMR stuff, all this other stuff that is, that's a long story. But the point here is that patients are feeling it. They see that, that this market is approached. It's a new thing about healthcare. They're blaming the Affordable Care Act in front of that. And part of it has them bringing truth to it, frankly. And, you know, the fundamental question that is not asked in any of your studies is healthcare a public good or a market commodity? Because we have to go back to the basics again, which unfortunately the pharmaceutical medical insurance industry won back in 2008. On which direction we're going to go as a nation on that fundamental question. And because we lost that issue, in my mind, and some of you like market-based medicine, but because most people in public health really think healthcare is a public good, it would be a totally transformative way of asking a very big question if we had actually embraced such a system, I think. And the survey could be very different.
So, I'm the incoming chair of the ethics section of the AHA.
Oh, good.
And I've already given two presentations the last few days, both of which have dealt with the firm belief that healthcare is a life, not a TRV, the journalist, wrote a book called The Healing of America, now many years old, but it's a wonderful book, looking at the healthcare systems in the other developed countries. And one of the conclusions he came to in studying what happened in other countries was that they all started with the question, is healthcare right? And they all accepted that moral responsibility, and then universal care flows from that determination, because if healthcare is a right, you can't let 30 million people outside. And so his argument was that that's where it should start. I have a presentation that I give that it's called Ain't My Knife. It's a reference to the On the Waterfront movie with Marlon Brando being told by his hoodlum brother, you know, that you gotta throw the fight because it ain't your knife. And that's what the Senate and the Obama administration told us in public health in 2009 and 2010, that it ain't your knife. I'm not interested in making a case for healthcare as a market, market-based approach to healthcare. What I'm interested in is looking at what if we had made the other decision, and now how close are we to what that would look like? So I think that's what enlivens our efforts.
Yes, ma'am, in the back.
So I'm a physician infectious disease, so I go from the YY. Practice protection in New York and California. So, and where am I? I'm in New York City. Mainly because I don't feel like I can take care of my patients anywhere else besides the care that I can. I agree with what you said right now that Medicaid has been available in New York State for many years because of access. And what happened when I moved back in 2011 is that they started managing Medicaid. Patients have to learn what was available, what was not available. I'm also fighting with insurance now, different Medicare plans, again, Medicaid, with trying to get medications for my patients. And that's where a lot of patients don't understand. I repeatedly tell my patients that I get upset when I hear about this 2 minutes, and yet we only get 20 minutes to see a patient. I try not to go by the 20 minutes, I go by what is necessary. So number one is primary care physician. Do they need to be physicians? Do you need to have to go to see nurse practitioners, PA? Number two, patient education, not just by the internet. lot of areas are not internet savvy or computer savvy. This is where the navigators come in to provide not just hands-on, but also cultural care centers in terms of by language and by the culture, so that they know what's going on. It's knowing how to utilize the system, not just by the patient, but by the provider, too. Hospitals, primary care settings, different areas. But at the same time, I am feeling for patients, I can prescribe you something, but it doesn't mean that you're going to get it. I don't decide that. The insurance decides that. And I say that as a physician. And I'm always on the phone fighting with insurance. I sometimes get very upset. And you wonder, like, why the primary care setting is burning out, because we are fighting with the insurance, not the insurance per se, but the formulary that was decided by that Medicare system for Medicaid, what was available for your patient. And yet, I can see Hep C, that's it, with Carvani, which is a $95,000 medication for 3 months of treatment. I can get that treatment for my patient. So where is the, and why am I in New York City versus where my family is in Texas? Because I don't try to take care of my patients there, unfortunately. I wish I could.
One last question.
So as a family medicine resident myself, practicing the primary care physician, when I do feel that primary care should still be investment in the physician for the main fact that we have the training in it, I do feel like they still need to be kind of the team with the patient, but also my patient level confidence.
We are officially, really, and truly out of time this night. Please give a big round of applause to our excellent presenters. And thanks very much to all of you for the great conversation after.